I think this story is pretty familiar to many of you, this healing of the boy with the evil spirit. It's a very moving story. Who wouldn't be interested in the story of a father and a son and the anguish of a father over his son who has this terrible condition which is brought on, which is controlled, which is manipulated by an evil spirit. So it's a very evocative story. And I suppose we want to place ourselves somewhere in this story. And of course, you will be familiar with the kind of central exclamation, "Lord, I believe, help my unbelief." And we want to place ourselves there, and I want to place us there this evening. Not a lot of walking around room up here. But I want us to be there this evening. But you wonder whether we're a bit further back that we're with the disciples, or even further back with the Pharisees and the scribes and the people generally with their skepticism, their kind of fascination, but fundamental skepticism. And that's the challenge that presents itself as we begin this section from Mark 9, from verse 14. And we're immediately confronted, really, with this faithless generation, a faithless generation, verses 14 through to 19. The three disciples plus Jesus, they descend from the mountaintop. They have seen the glory of Jesus. They have seen him transfigured, changed in his appearance before them. So they realize that he was powerful and glorious. So they've seen that, the three disciples, but they come down the mountain as we always come down the mountain. It's not quite so glorious being here on a Sunday, maybe some weeks, but whatever our good experiences of God, whatever our glorious experiences of God, of real intimacy and understanding and insight, we have to come down the mountain. Until Jesus comes again, we'll always be coming down the mountain after those mountaintop experiences, always down and always confronted by a faithless generation and sometimes the faithlessness of our own hearts. When these three plus Jesus come down the mountain, they see something of the plight, of the weakness, of the pettiness of men, the arguments, the failure, the opposition. Remember, the disciples are still in the presence of Jesus, and we're always in the presence of Jesus, but we're not always in the presence of Jesus on top of the mountain. We're having to come down into the valley. So there they are. They come down, and the people run to Jesus. Few people have wondered why they were amazed at Jesus and startled because of his appearance. You know, like Moses, when he saw the glory of God and his appearance was radiant afterwards. Some people think that, but most people think that's rather fanciful and that there was probably just a sense of relief and intrigue because, of course, they knew Jesus was the primary miracle worker. So there was kind of interest and excitement that the master, the rabbi, the teacher had arrived. And Jesus questions and says, what's all the commotion about? Verse 16, what are you arguing with them about? He asks his disciples. And it seems as though there is silence from the disciples. Maybe they're a bit ashamed, a bit embarrassed. And it seems as though there's silence from the crowd as well. But then a man in the crowd, verse 17, and we realize in a few moments that he's not just any old man in the crowd, but we think it's the same person speaking as it's clearly the same person speaking as the father a bit later on. So a man in the crowd answered, "Teacher, I brought you my son, who is possessed by a spirit that has robbed him of speech." He begins respectfully, "Teacher, rabbi, I brought my son," and Luke's gospel, we try not to sort of combine the gospels too much, but it's helpful to know from Luke's gospel that it was his only son that he brings. So he said, "I brought my only son to your disciples, and my only son, my son, has an impure spirit, an evil spirit. Demonic forces seize him and cause him to do all sorts of destructive things, convulsions, suicidal acts. And I brought him to your disciples," who clearly thought they could cast it out, but were completely unable to. And that's the reason for the argument of verse 14, clearly. And Jesus answers in what seems like exasperation and frustration. Verse 19, oh, unbelieving generation. There's a great sigh. I mean, what do we mean when we have an O? There's actually an O there in the Greek. It's nice and easy to translate. There's just a letter O. Oh, oh. I mean, how do you translate O? You translate it, oh. There's a kind of exasperation at, oh, unbelieving generation. How long shall I stay with you? I don't think it's saying, oh, I've had enough of you lot, I'm leaving. It's a kind of just a sense of how their unbelief frustrates him and how he will be moving on soon and they need to exercise faith. I wonder, as Jesus hears what you talk about and hears what you argue about and hears what you pray about, I wonder if Jesus would sigh, oh, this evening. Unbelieving generation. He's talking to his people, the people that should have welcomed the Saviour, the people that should have put their faith in the Saviour. He's talking to them and he says, oh, unbelieving generation. It's a challenge for us tonight. Are we that? Are we the unbelieving generation? We're God's people, yes, but we're unbelieving. We don't really believe in the power of God, in the power of Christ. And I wonder if we have a similar heart of exasperation, not critique, not looking down on, but just desperate exasperation with our generation, our nation. That we look out on our nation and we say, oh, unbelieving generation, how long have you got? Have mercy, Lord, as we were singing in that song earlier. Do you feel like that about the generation we live in? It's very easy because we are a minority and because we have the truth of God by God's grace to just look in on ourselves and just to kind of despise the other lot. We kind of crudely or superficially might say that the unwashed and the unbelieving and the perverse generation and all that, but not really with the compassion that Jesus shows. Oh, unbelieving generation. We live in an unbelieving generation. We live surrounded by people who have no belief in the power of Jesus. And just like it concerned Jesus and the urgency of the need that they have faith concerned Jesus, it should concern you this evening if you are a believer. So we see, first of all, a faithless generation. But we see that a faithless generation, what do they need to do? What do we need to do in all our fumbling faith? A faithless generation needs faith in the power of Jesus for salvation. See that from verse 20 through to 27. Jesus asks, what's going on? And Jesus says, bring the boy to you, the end of verse 19. So they brought him. And it says when the Spirit saw Jesus, not when the boy saw Jesus, when the Spirit saw Jesus, it immediately threw the boy into a convulsion. He fell to the ground and rolled around, foaming at the mouth. Some people have tried to explain this condition that the boy has as just epilepsy. You know, they called it evil spirits because they were primitives, and we call it epilepsy because we're well-educated. But it's clear that whatever physical component there was with the boy, whatever predisposition he might have, we have no idea. But what we do know is that there really was a spirit who was occupying this boy and controlling this boy in these moments of convulsion and of what we might call fit in a kind of medical language. And it's the spirit that sees Jesus and starts to react. He's under demonic power, and that power is at work opposing God at every corner. And Jesus asks the question, how long has he had this condition? And the man explains it's since childhood. I don't think Jesus is getting kind of medical condition. You know, if we go to a doctor, to explain our condition. They'll ask for a bit of medical history, won't they? You know, how long have you had this condition? What other symptoms have you got? And those sort of things. I don't think Jesus is trying to put together a diagnosis. Well, I'll just write these things down and I'll see if I think what the condition might be. It might be this, it might be this. It might be demonic activity. I don't think he's asking for that. I think what he's trying to do is show that he's talking to a real man with real life conditions, with a real life story about his son. And he shows concern about that. It's not like, yeah, miracle, tick the box here, it's done, that's sorted, go away. He's concerned about the man himself and his experiences, this lifetime of the son experience for the man of this going on. And he's developing a relationship with the man. It's very interesting, isn't it, in our evangelism, in our trying to tell people the gospel. You know, of course we're in a hurry to get to the salvation bit. And Jesus is going to bring a work of salvation to this man very soon. But maybe we hurry a bit, and I hurry a bit too much, over the kind of steps on the way. Understanding people's world, getting into people's world, worldview, world experiences. What has life been like for you up to this point? You need to get saved. No, what's life been like? You need to get saved. No, ask what has life been like for you up to this point? What have you experienced? What have you gone through? What do you like? What do you dislike? What do you care about? You need to follow Jesus in that, in the way he speaks. And I think as well as showing concern for the person, Jesus is also making clear for us and for everyone else that this is not a trivial matter, that it's not as though this boy has had the condition for 5 minutes. Now, it's not as though he kind of ate gone-off eggs or something earlier in the evening and that's causing it. He wants to make clear that there is a deep-rooted, long-standing problem with the boy. And that's why he's in that condition. So he shows concern for the person. He makes clear the scale of the condition, the scale of the problem, and the reality of it before he goes on to do anything else. And the man ends his description about his suicidal tendencies, verse 22. But if you can do anything, take pity on us and help us. It seems very reasonable at first, doesn't it, what the man says? You're kind of reading that through and you think, I don't think there's anything unusual about what he says. But if you can do anything, take pity on us and help us. And it's like Jesus fires back straight away. If you can, what are you saying? You see, his issue, the man's issue, was actually Jesus' ability. He was struggling to believe that Jesus was able. Quite different. Do you remember the leper, first chapter of Mark's gospel? The leper comes to Jesus and he says, if you are willing, you can make me clean. His problem, his challenge was, is Jesus willing to make me clean? That was his challenge. He thought he could, but was he willing? That's not the problem for this man here. The problem for this man here is, can he? Is he able? Does he have the power? This is a fundamental, deep-rooted, demonic problem. Does Jesus actually have the power? Do you actually have the power? If you can do anything, I'll take it. I'll take whatever help you can give. The man is struggling to believe that. And Jesus says more than just, if you can, in that kind of incredulous way. He goes on to say, everything is possible for him who believes. There's a parallel expression in chapter 10, verse 27, where it's talking about whether rich people could enter the kingdom. And Jesus says in verse 27, when the disciples say, well, who could be saved? Who is it possible for anyone to be saved? And Jesus says, with man this is impossible, but not with God. All things are possible with God. It's worth having that in mind as we think about what Jesus means here. Jesus says, my ability is not your question. Don't question my ability. Actually, don't question my willingness. I've demonstrated my willingness to heal. The question It's not my ability and it's not my willingness. What's the question? The question is, do you believe in the power of God? That's the question. It's not about our belief being somehow the merit for God to be gracious to us, but how do we receive the grace of God? It's by faith. Without faith, it's impossible to please God. Without faith, it's impossible to receive the mercy of God. So Jesus says, my ability is not the question, or my willingness. The question is, do you believe? Jesus says, I'm not constrained by your faith, but the way I choose to work, the way God chooses to work in the world, the way his purposes work out in the world, is not constrained by our faith, but he chooses, he wills that he responds to our belief. And as we exercise faith, the impossible gets done. The impossible gets done. And Jesus doesn't mean here, when he says everything is possible for him who believes, he doesn't say that faith can just accomplish anything. But what he means is this: for those with faith, you don't need to set limits on the power of God. It's in the context of what he talks about salvation in the next chapter, but it's also in the context of the particular challenge in front of him. This seemed like a really hard case because the disciples couldn't do it. And what Jesus is saying, don't put limits on the power of God. You put limits on the power of God. He could save this person, but he couldn't save this other person. Jesus says, don't put limits on the power of God. There's no limits to the possibilities of what God can do. And the man cries out in that memorable phrase, I do believe. Help me overcome my unbelief. The man says, I'm in a struggle. I'm in an internal struggle, a spiritual struggle between belief and unbelief. But as you're speaking to me, I realize that you can. And I reach out to you in believing, but at the same time recognizing so deeply my lack of belief. I believe, but I don't believe. Such a great expression that kind of rings down through the years. And we always feel that we somehow connect with that because we're always believing, but unbelieving. We're always reaching out and believing, but at the same time, we know the frailty of our unbelief, the frailty of our belief, that we're slipping back all the time into unbelief. He's fighting a battle, isn't he, against the reality of his circumstances, the length of time of the problem that it's been with him. But he's reaching out. He's praying to God for help. And interestingly, in verse 22, what he says is, go on helping me with my unbelief. When he talks about helping us in verse 22... It's a certain tense. I don't want to get into the whole Greek thing. But when he says here about help me overcome my unbelief, he says, it's a present continuous. He says, help me and go on helping me. So he's saying, I do believe you can do this. And I need you to help me and to go on helping me with struggling with my unbelief. That's great, isn't it? Because that's us. Present continuous struggle with unbelief. If you're not struggling with unbelief some days, you're not struggling with belief. I'm not sure there is a believer who doesn't struggle some days with unbelief, with moments of doubt in something to do with the power of God. And that's such a wonderful expression the man gives of the human condition and even the believer's condition of, I believe, but help my unbelief. Jesus looks, he sees the distress, he sees the crowds running to the scene in verse 25, and it says he rebuked the evil spirit. Maybe the crowd had drawn back a bit. There was a crowd and they withdrew a bit. And maybe they're coming back again because they sense a miracle is about to happen. So it seems as though Jesus, seeing the crowd, deals with it fairly quickly. He doesn't want to make a great spectacle of it in front of the people. So Jesus speaks. He commands the spirit out of the boy. It's not a trivial matter. There's a shriek. There's convulsions as he leaves the boy. And it seems for a moment as perhaps the boy's dead. The boy looked so much like a corpse that many said he's dead. There's a, not really a joke really, I suppose, but just a vaguely amusing expression, which is, an operation happens and the doctor says, yeah, the operation was really successful. Pause. But the patient died. And perhaps here you think, well, the operation was really successful. The evil spirit has been taken out, but the patient died. But no, the boy looked so much like a corpse that many said he's dead, but Jesus took him by the hand and lifted him up to his feet and he stood up. That whole kind of image of lifting him up and standing him up is a bit like the image of a resurrection, like he has come back from the dead. There's no indication that he was actually dead, but it's like he's come back from the dead. And that he's standing upright. That's a biblical idea, isn't it? Standing upright. It's where we get the whole idea of righteousness. It's to do with standing straight, standing upright. And I think that's what it's all about. This boy experiences a work of salvation. A few weeks ago, maybe a couple of months ago now, we had quite a lot of discussion in our community group about demons, about demon possession, about exorcism and all that kind of stuff. And I think we all pretty well demonstrated our ignorance of the subject, me especially. There are some fundamentals we can understand about the reality of demons, along with the reality of the devil, and the reality of some people in a special, unique way being taken over by demons. Jim talked about this a little bit when he was talking about the Syrophoenician woman a couple of months ago as well. That's one way that demons are active in the world. The other way is, of course, in the lies of Satan, in challenging people's faith and so on. But whatever we might say or know about demonic activity in the world now, this is not particularly an object lesson, a technical lesson about casting out demons. What Jesus, I think, is doing here is showing something of the nature of the kingdom. That Jesus the King enters the world, he's showing the victory of his kingdom over Satan and over death. And Jesus is doing saving works to people to show that he has come to do saving works for his people. He's showing that he's the true Messiah, and the miracles are part of the evidence, but they're also pictures of what it means to be saved. What does it mean to become a Christian? It means to be taken out of the kingdom of darkness, to stop being controlled by demons and the devil, and to be given new life and to be standing upright like this boy is. So the miracle tells us in general, Jesus' kingdom is breaking in and it's the victorious kingdom. But I think it shows us in particular, here's a work of salvation. Demon-possessed boy, upright, resurrected boy. That's your experience if you became a Christian. That you are working the agenda of the devil, and as good as dead, and now you're standing upright, living, ready to serve. That's what happens when you become a Christian, and that's a great picture of it here. He's showing us how people get saved, how this man and his family get rescued, and how by his faltering faith he reaches out to a powerful God. We need to believe that Jesus can save. And we need to believe that Jesus can save us. If you're not a Christian here this evening, or maybe listening to the recording, if you're not a Christian, how do you get saved? How do you get rescued from your guilt before God, from your spiritual deadness, from your lack of relationship with God, from you being under the control of the devil? How do you get rescued from that? It's by putting your trust in Jesus. And this family experience a work of salvation through belief. And we need to believe in the power of Christ, that he really can save us. Some people look at us and say, I wish I had your faith. Some people look at Christians and say, I wish I had your faith. I wish I had your depth of faith. But it's important to realize that what's not the question here is not the quality of our faith, it's the object of our faith. I'm sure you can figure out the difference. It's not the quality of our faith. It's not like this man had extraordinary faith. There were people with what you might call better quality faith in the New Testament who confront Jesus. But it wasn't the quality of his faith that was particularly impressive here, was it? It was struggling faith. It was faltering faith. What really won the victory here? It wasn't the quality of the faith. It was the object of the faith, Jesus, and the power of Jesus. Do you believe in the power of Jesus to save you? Oh. Thirdly, what we see here is faith in the power of Jesus for effective service. Why did the disciples fail in the last few verses of our section? This kind of an explanation starts to unravel. Jesus goes indoors and his disciples asked him, why couldn't we drive it out? And he says, this kind can come out only by prayer. And at first reading, you think, okay, so what was wrong was they had the wrong technique. Maybe they did things in the wrong order. Maybe more prayer. Perhaps fasting. There is some translations that include fasting as well. But I think if you take the story as a whole and you think about Jesus and the transfiguration on the mountain, then he comes down, then he sees an unbelieving generation, and then in the middle of the story, at the kind of next mountaintop moment of the story, there's the man struggling with his belief but reaching out in faith to Jesus. So you've got the unbelieving generation, and remember Jesus is talking to everybody, he's talking to the disciples as well. As he says this, unbelieving generation, man of faith, the disciples didn't pray. What's the point? The disciples didn't really believe in the power of Jesus, or maybe didn't apply to Jesus for his power to be at work. The power of God rests on Jesus. And I think what's going on here is that the disciples' lack of prayer is a sign of their lack of faith. You can look at Matthew 16 and 20, and that verse 20, and that seems to kind of expand a little bit and explain it in that way. But even just taking Mark's gospel on its own merits, without comparing with the other gospels, I think it's clear that the issue here is faith. Believing, not believing. Here's the man believing. Here are the disciples not believing, or at least not expressing their belief by prayer. So let's just think about those two things, believing and praying, as we try and serve. First of all, let's think about the believing. We thought for a few moments already about, do you believe in the power of God to save you? Do you believe in the power of God to save other people? Do you actually believe in the power of God? Sometimes I'm not sure I do. Sometimes I trust my own power to save. Perhaps that's what the disciples were doing. They might have thought that they should be successful. They'd been successful before. Jesus has sent them out on mission tours before now, and they'd cast out demons already. So perhaps they're relying on themselves. But maybe they don't believe that Jesus can do it. Maybe they don't believe in the power of Jesus. And I wonder if we do. Particularly to the hard cases. Here's a really hard case. And we think, well, there are some people I reckon I could persuade them to be a Christian. Because I'm pretty bright and I've got all the arguments. I reckon I could persuade them. But then over here there are some really hard cases and I don't know what we do with them. Maybe that was kind of the mentality of the disciples. Maybe that's kind of the mentality of you. By this story provokes in us the question, do you believe in the power of Jesus? Not your power, not your technique, but you do really believe in the power of Jesus to save and to save anyone. Is it great that it's not dependent on our technique? Because we're pretty useless, really. Pretty useless intellectually. There's only a kind of few people across the whole of the Christian faith who are really bright, like proper intellectuals who can sit and debate about anything. And not brilliant technically and all those things and can't often remember things very well and don't always live consistent life. So how hopeless it would be if it was just depending on my technique or my past successes. So let's chuck that in the bin. But having done that, do you actually believe Jesus can save the hardest cases? There are people you've been witnessing to. There's people I've been witnessing to. For many years, why don't they get saved? Well, in the end, of course, it's the sovereign choice of God who gets saved. It's his sovereign way of working. But I wonder if we lose the real belief that Jesus can actually save the hardest cases. Some people, maybe they're not because we just exaggerate, but some people we talk to, we think they really are the hardest cases. They really are fundamentally lost, without hope. I wonder if this story is provoking you to say, do you believe? Do you believe God can save that person that you just don't seem to be getting through to, that seems like they've got this kind of suit of armor on that's impenetrable? However you witness to them, whatever you do, and you talk about life stories, that doesn't work, and you try the intellectual arguments, and that doesn't work, and personal testimony, and that doesn't work, and you try and make friends with them, and that doesn't work, and you think, I don't know how they're ever going to be saved. How can anyone be saved? And Jesus' words, well, with you, of course, no, but with God, all things are possible. Everything is possible for those who believe. Do you believe? And do you pray? We're trying this year to emphasize, to encourage a life of prayer. Half of you are falling asleep this evening. Is it warm in here? Just wake up for the last 2 minutes, can you? That'd be good. Do you have a life of prayer? Because you might kind of mentally assent to the idea, I believe in the power of Jesus to save, but it has to find its way into our life of prayer. Because I believe in the power of Jesus to save, I'm going to witness to people because it's by the word that they get saved. But because I believe in the power of Jesus to save people, I will pray for the power of Jesus to be exercised through my words and through the words of others. And so this year, and of course every year, but particularly this year, we're trying to say to the church, pray. Pray and pray. Keep on praying. Find lots of opportunities to pray. Take all the extra opportunities there are to pray. Pray for the power of God to be displayed. Every Sunday as we gather together and there are Christians struggling in their faith and there are those who need to be encouraged as they're downcast and there are those who need to be quickened, brought to life by the word. Pray that that would happen. Pray for your personal witness. Pray for the witness of your friends. Find out the friends and the family of people in your community group and pray for them as well. Pray that God, who does the impossible, would do the impossible, the seemingly impossible, in the lives of your friends and family. Pray for people. Pray for your own contacts. Pray that God would be at work. Because to serve effectively, we need to be prayerful. And the more prayerful we are, the more effective we will be. And we know that's true. But there's always something else to do. And sometimes what we're doing is okay, and sometimes what we're doing is just as bad as the disciples. We're just arguing amongst ourselves. We're just having petty arguments about who's the best at doing this or that, or why this or thing went wrong. And of course we've got to think, what's the best way in our particular generation to communicate the gospel? We've got to think about that, but in the end, we've just got to be ourselves. We've just got to be ourselves in the generation that we are. So not be a previous generation, but to be contemporary, we just be ourselves in trying to communicate the gospel in the kind of normal ways that people do, and normal kind of meetings, the normal kind of rooms with the normal kind of voices, with the normal kind of music that people are used to. That's what we do, so we don't have to think about it that much. It's not about technique, it's not about past performance, it's about the power of Jesus, and we need to be prayerful. And it's not about just ticking off. We've arranged some extra prayer meetings. Mark was encouraging us to think about the main monthly prayer meeting and whether we're there and other prayer occasions. This morning I was thinking about that. And it's great to get along to them. And some of you don't, and I wonder why. But it's not really about just ticking the box to say I turned up to this meeting or that. It's about the disposition of dependence on God that is the life of prayer. Not the moment of prayer, but the life of prayer. Do you believe in the power of God to save the hardest cases? Will you pray to God to save the highest cases, the hardest cases? To get saved and to get others saved, we need to be like this man, don't we? Exclaiming to God, exclaiming, Jesus, I do believe. Help me overcome my unbelief. Go on helping me overcome my unbelief. To get saved myself, to see others come into the kingdom, for me to persevere, for passion for life, for my friends, for my neighbours, for the growth of this church, for the children's work, for the glory of the name of Christ in this nation. Help me overcome my unbelief. I do believe you have power to save.